Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and joining me tonight are Rachel Elaine. Say hello.
Well, hello, Rachel Elaine.
And Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
We were supposed to have John Kaufman. He may still show up, but much as the characters in the films we'll be discussing, we're going to carry on. And the films we're going to be discussing are those from, well, possibly, well, to me, my favorite anime company. Now, how do we want to pronounce this? I keep hearing it pronounced three or four different ways. So, Rachel, it's Studio...
I say
what did we decide it was called?
Ghibli.
Mm-hmm. Ghibli. Yep, I've always said Ghibli.
I will say that I am not a professional. I don't know. So you guys, I'm going to defer to you on this, but forgive me if I slip up.
Yep. So tonight, of course, that means that we're going to be focusing on directors Isao Takahata and Hayao Miyazaki. These are guys whose careers stretch way back into the 60s. Men who started out working a lot in television. Miyazaki did some episodes of the famous Lupin the Third series, including Castle of Cagliostro, which Steven Spielberg has cited. Yep, which Steven Spielberg has cited as a huge influence on the way that he likes to storyboard action sequences. And when you watch that, you can definitely feel the influence of the car chase up the side of the hill in Lupin the Third on the truck scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's undeniably there. So
I think that I am the only 35-year-old woman I know who actually owns the entire VHS copy series of Lupin the Third. Which was weirdly in, like, French. So,
oh, no, that's because it's based on a series of French novels, I believe.
We talked about that. There is a Netflix revival of that series because it's actually a book series from like the 1800s. Starts talk to Carl about it. He's all up on it. But yeah, there's a new Netflix series called Lupin, and it is a French Netflix series, and it is based on that. And the only thing I could think of the whole time I was watching it, other than that it was amazing, was I just kept remembering seeing this anime from my childhood and thanking my stepdad for introducing me to such weirdness.
Well, you know, so we always like to start out with this question. I'm going to throw it to Aaron first. So, Aaron, how did we first become aware of the works of these two men? And, you know... Which of the two did we see work from first?
Miyazaki first. First and forever. the story I like to tell, and I'll tell the real story afterwards, is that in high school, a friend of mine randomly got into anime. I say randomly because he had never been into anime before, and all of a sudden he was in over his head, brought over two films for me to watch, and they were Princess Mononoke and Ninja Scroll, and we watched that and immersed ourselves in incredibly violent Japanese cartoons for an afternoon.
And who doesn't do that once in a while?
Life was never the same.
I mean, Ninja Scroll, nothing wrong with a little of the old ultraviolet, eh? I mean, demons drinking from torn limbs and rape and murders and you know, it heads getting cut off. It's awesome.
Of course, as an adult, I went back and watched the Ghibli films and saw Kiki's Delivery Service and had a vivid memory of having seen that as a child. So actually, Kiki's Delivery Service, still Miyazaki, was my first. Takahata, I got to in college. This is the first time I'm going to mention this in a while. Roger Ebert's Great Movies book. he had essays on both My Neighbor Totoro and Grave of Fireflies. And having seen Princess Mononoke, I was all in for My Neighbor Totoro. And, well, those of you who have seen children, Grave of Fireflies, know what I was in for when I got around to that.
Yeah, you know,
I really hope you're not showing that to your children.
Well, you know, I'm going to say this. I think that I may have, you know, seen Totoro here and there, because Totoro was such a famous little figure that I may have kind of become aware of Totoro first, but I remember seeing Princess Mononoke in the theater in late 97, early 98, and being blown away by it. But I can't for the life of me remember if I know that's the first film that I saw from either Takahata or Miyazaki, but I'm fairly sure that I had heard Roger Ebert mention Grave of the Fireflies on Siskel and Ebert in an episode the two of them did on their favorite animated films.
He almost certainly did.
And Ebert, of course, is not wrong when he calls it one of the great war or anti-war films of all time. It's an extraordinary film, and I really do hope we get a chance to go in depth on that harrowing work. Rachel, what about you?
Well, honestly, for me, I grew up in a family that did a lot of weird things. Mostly, we did a number of different historical reenactment groups. And one of the historical reenactment groups we did also sponsored partially the regional cons out here in Arkansas. We've had them for a long time, by the way. And so I grew up going to regional comic cons and sci-fi cons in Little Rock, and I was introduced to, well, anime a really, really long time ago by my super awesome stepdad, who is in his 70s and is the reason that I have all of the Lodoss Wars. I have all of Star Blazers. I have all of Lupin the Third. I have the original animes, and that's what I grew up watching. So I was introduced, and it was Miyazaki, to Spirited Away back in 2001 when I went to, at that time, it was called RockCon, because Little Rock, Arkansas, RockCon. And the anime room was playing some really cool movies, and I went in there, and Spirited Away was playing. And somebody had actually just come back from overseas with their copy of this movie that had just not been dubbed. It had only been subtitled at this point. And I saw for the first time, like, the first actually kind of kid-friendly anime. And being, you know, a young adolescent at that point, it really hit with me. And from there is when, you know, you go on to watch everything else. I mean, there's so many. Howl's Moving Castle, My Neighbor, I'm sorry, some of this is getting into, why can't I remember his name? I'm so sorry.
Takahata.
Yes. But I really, they feel like they're kind of the same entity to me because they did do a lot of work together, especially in the beginning. There's a lot of collaboration between these two. But yeah, from there it's like, oh, the anime is not all just dismemberment and death and, and, you know, like lifelong battles and wars that you don't even really understand. Wow. So
you know, that
kind of
leads right into my next question. You know, I think that, you know, people generally know what animation is. But when you say anime, they think, oh, that's that Japanese stuff, right? Well, I want to ask this. What makes anime different? And it is different. Let's make no mistake. From other kinds of animation. Aaron?
I've been thinking about this. I think that it's, well, first of all, it's uniquely Japanese and steeped in Japanese cultural and historical notes, despite its French origins, but we won't get into that.
Good one.
I think, though, that because it's so Japanese and the Japanese don't make family movies and adult movies and kids movies, they just make movies and everybody watches them, that they wrestle with much more mature themes even in their animated films. You have some R-rated American animated movies. Anomalisa comes to mind, South Park, stuff like that, which is in Charlie Kaufman's
it's used for surrealism,
the animation. And in the case of South Park, of course, they're deconstructing the children's genre. So when Americans do R-rated cartoons, they're doing it to speak to animation as a medium, whereas the Japanese are making movies that live actors. So it's kind of a rambling, incoherent response that I'll get 0 points for. But I think ultimately the more mature themes, the darker moods, and of course the gigantic eyes.
Well, yeah, and in the case of you know, and I do think this is specific to Studio Ghibli, but I think anime, and I was thinking about this as I was revisiting bits and pieces of the films, it seems to me like the use of music in anime is a little different. And that may be a Japanese thing because it reminds me of the way that music was used in films by, say, Ozu, Mizoguchi, Kurosawa, even the way that Kurita uses very light scores in his films now. You know, I think we'll get to that later as well. So what about you, Rachel? What to you makes anime different from other kinds of animation?
Well, considering that I am a huge, huge fan of animation, and like I was discussing with you, you know, pre-show, there is a very interesting show coming up that we have some great animators coming on. I could talk to you about the technical differences in the animation, in the fact that there's, you know, in different kinds of anime, like Samurai Jack, even though it's American, is considered an anime. It's different from all other cartoons in that it's the first animated cartoon show that didn't have the black lines around it. Like, if you watch animation, everything is outlined in black. And that's the first show that didn't do that. And, of course, they later went on with Lilo and Stitch and did that movie entirely in watercolor. Glorious. But I digress there. What I think really, for me, differentiates anime from animation is the hyper-stylization of anime. You can look at a drawing and be like, okay, that's a drawing of a cartoon, or that's a drawing of an anime. You know it's hyper-stylized. It's usually got a lot of color, a lot of flash, and a lot of pop to it. But also the thing that really, really differentiates for me is the dichotomy of the hyper-stylization versus they will go into basic shapes type animation to convey really basic emotions for things. It's like you go from this hyper-stylized gun war to somebody, you know, somebody hits their funny bone, and it's like a little circle, ouchy face, and they're like, ah!
Or you know, especially like in some of those teen-oriented romance anime, you'll see somebody's eye suddenly for like a cell or two become hearts when they see the person they're in love with.
Exactly. But for the rest of the time, when you see their eyes, especially if they focus on them, like it's such beautiful animation that you could probably see the galaxy floating in the iris. And that's what makes anime for me is there's that, I mean, No Face in Spirited Away. Like, he's really basic shapes, basic cartoon-ass dude floating around in this hyper-stylized, realistic world, and you don't think anything of it because that's anime.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, that's how they do.
Yep. So, you know, I want to ask just what sets Ghibli apart from other studios? Aaron?
I think that Ghibli is more focused on younger viewers. That's not to say they make children's films, though they certainly have. And Princess Mononoke is certainly not for children. But I think that if you look at something like Akira or Ninja Scroll or something along those lines, Tokyo Godfather, they're adult films that are animated. And I think Ghibli is more focused on younger viewers, people who are learning who they are and what their place in this world is, and even though they're small, how they can affect change and affect meaning into their lives and onto their surroundings.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I was going to say, so Rachel Hugh.
You said that a lot better than I could, because my answer was going to be what makes the difference between these two studios is, well, I have two children, one of which is about to be 4, one of which is about to be 12, and they can watch all the Ghibli films. Takahata, on the other hand, I mean, I made the mistake of accidentally watching, this is not a Takahata film, but this is why I can't do this to my child. I made the mistake of watching The Boy in the Striped Pajamas with my, at the time, 10-year-old.
Oh, well.
Wow, and then I did have to justify it by saying this really happened to people, and it's really important that we understand that these things happened in the world, and we have to know that this happened, and we have to hurt so that we understand how not to make it happen in the future. But, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry you were not supposed to watch that movie with me. And, yes, that's why we're not doing Grave of Fireflies right now. And
I don't have to worry about that. I was like 6, 7, 8 watching films on slavery and the Holocaust when I was a kid. So I think that, you know, as long as you've got someone there that can give you historical context, depending on the maturity level of the child, that's not always a bad thing.
Exactly.
To expose children to.
And I do. Both of my parents are historians, and so I guess vicariously, de facto, even though that's not my thing, I know a lot about history, so I was able to explain it to my kid in a way that was like, yeah, it really sucks, and I'm sorry that you're crying, but you need to be crying right now because you have to understand this. But
see, and that's interesting because Aaron and I, we're both the historians and lit guys, so yeah, this all works out.
I'm a lit girl hardcore, but. Wow, I will say that that's my whole point. I totally agree with you there. Miyazaki, just on the standalone point, that for the Ghibli Studios, just the stuff that is strictly Ghibli Studios, because technically Grave of Fireflies and stuff like that is associated with them. They're definitely
Grave was released the same day as Totoro, Miyazaki, and Takahata.
As a double feature.
Yep, they released it as a double feature, and Takahata's actually, because usually you'd think, Miyazaki's the nice one, and he's the one to make the joke. No, Takahata said, well, we decided that we'd have the theater schedule it, they'd show my film first, and then they'd show Totoro to give them something to smile about.
What's really strange about all of it was that Ghibli obviously was just starting at that point. They'd really only released Castle in the Sky.
Yeah, they'd only had like three years of business by that time, I think, four.
Yeah, and Miyazaki pitched Totoro and they turned him down. And then Takahata got the green light on Grave of Fireflies, and he pitched Totoro again. And they said, only if you show it as a double feature with this, because we think this will make money and yours won't. And, of course, Totoro went on to become, like, iconic. And, I mean, we all love Grave of Fireflies.
The studio mascot.
but it's not Totoro in that, like, people who don't know animation know who Totoro is.
Yeah, I mean, you see that big fluffy character, and you go, oh, him, that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we where do you think they got the idea for Pusheen the cat? Pusheen the cat is very much a Totoro homage. But you know. I'm going to jump ahead to one of our later questions. So, Aaron, what would be your choice amongst these films to introduce someone to these directors with?
Each director?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I think you got to go with Totoro. For Miyazaki, just get them hooked before you challenge them, I think. Takahata's tougher because he's a tougher person to get into. I might go with Only Yesterday. I think it's not super easy. It's not like a small children's movie, but it's not Grave of Fireflies. nor is it the really complex narrative and challenging animation style of some of his later films.
Yeah, it's not Princess Kaguya.
Yeah.
You know, with me, I think you make an interesting point. I'm almost tempted to go with My Neighbor's Yamadas because just such a light, fun film. It's a bunch of vignettes, and yet underneath it all is the seriousness with which he always treats his characters. And by that, I mean the way that he respects them as fully fleshed characters.
I think that the minimalist animation style could be off-putting, too, because there's no backgrounds.
That is the one thing that keeps me from going full blast on that.
Yeah,
but,
I thought about that one, too.
So Takahata is really hard for me. But for me, you know, I think you have something there with Totoro. But, you know, I'm going to say that for Miyazaki, it's going to depend. I'm going to have to cheat here a little bit. And it really depends on the person. Most people, I'm going to probably agree with you and say Totoro. Other people, I'm going to give them Princess Mononoke, even more than Spirited Away, because I think that Princess Mononoke in some ways may be his best film and may be the film that for me says the most about what he is about as a filmmaker. And I think that if you can sit through that film and love it, then you're probably going to be in. So that's my take. But what about you, Rachel?
Well, I actually have a bit of a different take on this. And if we're going to talk about getting people into these older and I hate to say that because they still feel very new and relevant to me. If we're going to talk about getting people into some of these older animes, I will tell you from personal experience, my almost 12-year-old child was gifted this Christmas with the books of Nausicaä of the Valley of
the Wind. Oh, God, I love Nausicaä.
And they just found out today, because they were talking to Mommy about their podcast they were going to be on tonight. And I was like, oh, my God, baby, I think you're really going to love the podcast that I'm doing. It's, you know, Takahata and Miyazaki movies. And they were like, what? Like, eyes down to the ground. We really do have an anime duvet cover coming for their bed spread here. It's being ordered from overseas. It'll be here in a week. So they got gifted the books, like the, and it's a giant, like, two-book massive series. Just found out today that is actually an anime, and I'm probably going to spend the rest of my weekend watching that. So if you want to know what I think the best thing to introduce somebody to from either of these guys, it's definitely going to be Nausicaä. Because I currently have an 11-year-old that is obsessed. So.
Mm-hmm. So what about for Takahata?
As for Takahata, I will be really, really honest with you guys. I'm not as familiar with him. And I've even been, like, super stalking his IMDb and stuff. Some of the things that I've seen on there, I am familiar with the 1974 series Heidi, Girl of the Alps that he was a part of. But beyond that, really, Lupin the Third.
So did you see, I mean, so you mean you still haven't seen Pompoko about the raccoons that battle each other by swinging their testicles at one another?
The weirdest thing about that is my family has a super creepy, fun inside joke about raccoons. My stepfather was drawn by a very famous animator, and he was put into the cartoon that the guy did. But he did anthropomorphic people for his cartoon. So my father was drawn as a raccoon, and it was the most accurate drawing of this man I've ever seen in my life. So we have, like, so many jokes about raccoons. And considering that he's the guy that introduced me to anime, including, like, Ranma One Half and Dragon Half and all the weird stuff, Project Aiko, I am really shocked that I have not even heard of Pompoko before.
Yeah.
Shocked.
It's weird. I saw it once. I own a copy of it because I picked up a complete Ghibli set a while back. I am actually almost afraid to rewatch it, not because I'm actually scared of the movie. I just remember going, okay, so I've seen it, and I am far from the most timid person, but it was such a strange fucking experience that I don't know, you know, if I
if you want to class it up.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
could think of it as Watership Down with raccoons. Of
yeah,
course,
except,
that's
you know,
not
I'm
an
be
accurate
honest,
depiction at all, but...
Yeah, yeah. Now, Watership Down, now there's a great book and a great movie, but that's a topic for another time. So, you know, I really do want to ask this question as well, and I'll go with you, Aaron. What makes these two men different? What is the big difference between the works of Miyazaki and Takahata?
Despite the fact that we just spent 5 minutes talking about raccoons fighting each other with their testicles and becoming human beings.
Hey, I've seen other animes like that. I'm just saying.
Miyazaki is a fantasy director. And Takahata is a realist. He taps into Japanese legend, but his characters are grounded. Miyazaki believes in magic. And I don't know if that's literally true, but it seems to be the wonder and majesty that he brings to his films. Also, Miyazaki has a very distinct animation style, whereas Takahata can do kind of more Miyazaki style or really off-the-wall kinds of animation. We talked about Yamada's being very minimalist. Tale of the Princess Kaguya is possibly the most gorgeous animated film ever made, and it's made with colored pencils, I believe.
And it looks like a bunch of watercolors come to life. It's like a Monet painting is moving.
It's just gorgeous. Those are, in my mind, the two biggest differences between the two.
For me, between the two, I agree with both of you. And with Miyazaki, it's not to me necessarily the magic. It's that he focuses more on the traditional culture and the tales that you know have survived the centuries that base the things that they do in their daily lives and why they do them. Now, Takahata, he does that, but he does it with history. and facts and things that have been already proven to have happened. So it does. It feels like one of the guys is more fantasy, but very grounded, because this is, you know, an entire culture that he bases a lot of his movies on. And the other guy is very grounded in the reality of, I'm going to show you what happened, but I'm going to do it with pretty cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something. Yeah, we could. That works. That definitely works. So, you know, hold on a second. My question list just went away. Bear with us, folks. Live radio. When computers glitch. Okay, so here's the next question, or set of questions. And this is going to be easy. What's our favorite and least favorite film from each director, and why? And on top of that, let's also give an unheralded gem that we think deserves more attention from each of them. And I'll start with you, Aaron.
Well, I said Miyazaki first and forever, so we'll start with him. My favorite is Spirited Away. My least favorite, though it is a romp, is Porco Rosso. And an unheralded gem. Ooh. I'll come back to that. Takahata. Well, we have to differentiate between best and favorite. So my favorite is The Tale of Princess Kaguya. And my least favorite, this is hard because he didn't make bad movies. Oh, gosh. It's the one I said that I was going to recommend to people who want to get into his week only yesterday. Which is a wonderful movie, but probably his least film. The unheralded gem for... I'm going to go with Pompoko because it's just so ridiculously strange, and my wife is fist pumping out in the living room. Yeah.
Oh, it is bizarre as hell. It really is.
I'm going to throw one way out. I'm going to go with Ponyo for my unheralded gem for Miyazaki. I think most people would put that in the least camp, but I think it's one of my favorite versions of Little Mermaid ever made.
Oh, it's a lovely film. It really is a lovely little film. So what about you, Rachel?
Well, I'm not going to be nearly as interesting here because, again, I don't have as much a connection with Takahata. But I'm going to say, obviously, probably my favorite from Miyazaki. Well, it might not be that obvious, but I did... Sorry, I'm losing everything that I'm doing right now. was Spirited Away, and that was because it was what introduced me to this particular style of animation. So for Miyazaki, we're going to do Spirited Away. I'm sorry, I know it's so cliche, but my unheralded gem here, Nausicaa.
Nausicaa is, have you seen the Blu-ray of Nausicaa?
I have not seen the Blu-ray. Literally, I just, like a year and a half ago, I bought a Blu-ray player, which happens to be my PS4, which is now sitting on my desk, and I am looking at it forlornly here in the Magic Studio, because I have to go take it to the shop and get it fixed, because, yeah, I used my PS4 for everything! I don't have to worry.
Well, I'm going to suggest a PS5, and if you can afford it, I'm going to truly suggest getting a region-free or a multi-region Blu-ray player, both Sony and LG, and Samsung, to a lesser degree, have a really good all-purpose Blu-ray and DVD players, and for people like us who love movies and television from around the world, I can't stress how important it is to have a player that will not lock you out of any region.
My partner just built a supercomputer 3 days ago, and by supercomputer, I mean we now have 11 terabytes of memory.
Incredible.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I could go through, like, I'm looking at the boxes, the ones that I haven't burned in the trash pile yet. We have a B550 Tomahawk AMD motherboard. A
yep.
C850 ATX PSU.
Enough of that.
I can stream or do anything ever now, and I have no problems with it. And we actually have the adapters in there to be able to let me watch things from other countries now, and I'm very excited because now I can buy nowhere.
Yeah, I really do think that anybody that likes movies and TV like we do really needs to have access. I understand and can respect the general idea on the one hand for region locking, and on the other hand, I fucking hate it and think that it is extremely anti-consumer. You know, the fact
Absolutely.
That you can only get Billy Wilder's last movie on a Spanish and Italian language disc. It comes with the English audio and subs if you need it. But it's a terrible film. But why should the final film of one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lived not be available in the country that he did most of his work in? You know,
right,
it would be
like
Kurosawa's last film not being available in Japan.
Exactly. Like the Greg Araki trilogy, the fucked up trilogy, I think that's actually what it's called. With Doom Generation, Nowhere, and Totally Fucked Up. You actually can't get Totally Fucked Up in America. I mean, I can. I can order it from Amazon right now. I just have to make sure that I have an Australian or New Zealand fucking DVD player. But that's the only way you can buy that movie. And I don't understand when I first saw Spirited Away, and that's what was so interesting to me, is when I first saw it, like, I live in a very, very deep south rural area, and I just happen to live next to an Air Force base, so we get a lot of people from overseas. They get a lot of crazy stuff from overseas. I saw Spirited Away the year that it came out on DVD, but only because somebody was at a convention and they had the conversion DVD player because they'd been overseas, obviously, like, you know, fighting in the wars and killing people and stuff, but yay, they got a great DVD player and an awesome movie out of it. So,
mm-hmm.
I do not understand that.
Mm-hmm. So the next question I want to ask moves a little bit away from Takahata and Miyazaki, and I think it's important that we cover the studio so that we understand their place in the studio. I'm going to throw this question first to Aaron. Beyond Miyazaki and Takahata, is there work at Ghibli that matches the best of their work?
I'm going to name two.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll save the obvious one for last. the first I'm going to mention has two titles. I prefer the long one, The Secret World of Arrietty, which is a retelling of The Borrowers. And It is just wonderful. I believe Miyazaki wrote it but didn't direct it. It has a very Miyazaki feel to it.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Yeah, okay. The other one he also wrote but did not direct, and this is the tragic tale of Studio Ghibli, of course, and that's Whispers of the Heart, which was directed by supposed to be their successor at Ghibli, who died very young after only one masterwork of a feature. Though it got a really weird sequel, possibly the weirdest sequel, a non-sequitur sequel of all time.
Yeah. So what about you, Rachel? Is there anything from the studio that isn't Miyazaki and Takahata that you think is the equal of their works?
Well, to be really honest with you guys, and I'm going to sound like such a dumbass here, but I don't know much of the rest of the studio's work beyond just what Miyazaki or Takahata and Miyazaki were associated with to really appropriately answer that question. If you ever want to talk about Leica animation or anything like that, I know all those guys. But I don't know what I've seen from those respective guys that's not associated with the two studios. Or I guess I don't know what I've seen from the studios that isn't associated with those two respective gentlemen, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have one more.
Oh, yeah?
When Marnie Was There is also a gorgeous film.
Yeah. So what we're going to do now is we're going to spend about, I think we can spend about 2 or 3 minutes on each film. I'm not going to go in strict chronological order. We're going to save some of the larger films for later so that we can have sort of maximize what we're doing here. And I'm going to start with Takahata's filmography. And let's start with Only Yesterday. Now, Rachel, I know you said you haven't seen much Takahata. Have you seen Only Yesterday?
I have not.
Okay, so I'll let Aaron speak really quickly on Only Yesterday. What are your views on Only Yesterday?
It's really just a nice, sweet little film. Girl moves out, like so many of the great Ghibli films, to live with an aunt. You'll have to forgive me. It's been a couple of years. And she meets a boy, and they kind of have this just nice, sweet summer relationship kind of deal. All of a sudden, I'm not remembering this film at all, even though it's one that I really like. Oh, my goodness.
And I think that that's problem with it. It is one of, it reminds me of like a summer Hallmark movie, Ghibli style.
Yes.
It's totally inoffensive, totally harmless. It's a nice movie, but, you know, it just doesn't have as much there as some of their other work. Now, we've gone through Pompoko quite a bit, so we're not going to talk about Pompoko. But I do want to talk about My Neighbors the Yamadas. Now, have you seen that one, Rachel?
I have not. I feel like such a dummy right now.
Okay, no worries. So it'll just be Aaron and I on this. So you can, like, sit back with a cup of coffee and cry. So
I am.
So,
I'm actually crying tonight, but that's a different story.
Too bad. So, Aaron, what do you think of My Neighbors the Yamadas?
This was a riot. Can I invoke Ozu?
Mm-hmm.
it really reminds me of Ozu in not any kind of way that you might expect. It's a movie about a family who truly loves each other but doesn't understand each other at all, dealing with the advent of the modern world in a very traditional country. It does this through a series of really funny and at times poignant vignettes with really interesting minimalistic animation.
Mm-hmm. No, I love it. As I said earlier, it's just such a lovely, lovely film. You then have some other things, and we're gonna hold on 1 second. My list just went away. Don't you love when your list actually just goes away? So
You know what God does when you give him plans, right?
Oh yeah, God laughs, man weeps.
Yeah. See, that's why I try to make lists, but I laugh every time I do because I know I'm gonna lose it anyway. So
yeah, no.
Let's just freeball it, man.
So here it is. We also have for Takahata. His last movie, he didn't direct it, but he produced it. And I want to ask a question. Did either of you see The Red Turtle?
Yes.
I did not.
Okay, so Aaron, what did you think of The Red Turtle? Because I thought it was a pretty stunning piece of art, and I really hope that they can keep up their association with that director, even though he's French. It would be unusual for a Japanese studio to work with him, but I love the collaboration.
Yeah. So this was one done completely without dialogue. If there was dialogue, it was like 5 words.
Yeah, it might have been like an owl or something like that as somebody stubbed their toe.
Right. How to explain? It's a complete spiritual experience. Like, it's one you have to see. I'll leave it at that.
I will even go so far as to say it reminded me.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say it reminded me of something from, like, Murnau, like watching The Last Laugh or Sunrise.
Yeah. Except for Deserted Island.
Yeah. So, you know, you also have, as I said, you know, now that kind of does it for Takahata and his minor works. We'll get to his major works later. I want to kind of go back to Miyazaki. Now, I know that you've seen, this is something that he did with Takahata, a lot of the Lupin series. So, and of course this is before the Studio Ghibli era, but what are your feelings on that Lupin show really quickly, Rachel?
Honestly, when I was younger and I didn't realize, like, necessarily how old the show was, I wasn't that into it. But as I got older, I started to love it more and more for, like, the mystery, the intrigue, the storyline, and the fact that it was just so fucking ridiculous. Oh, my God. Even the theme song is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my fucking life. And there we go.
Now, Aaron, I can't remember. I don't think you've seen any of the Lupin stuff.
No.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned earlier, Castle of Cagliostro is the film that he did of it. And the film, Castle of Cagliostro, is actually really fun. I'm not going to call it a great movie, but it's a fun movie. It's not bad by any means. It's just, it doesn't reach the artistic levels of his best work, but it's a lot of fun. Like I said, I mentioned that Spielberg was very influenced by it, and you know, there's a lot of Miyazaki in the 60s and 70s and a lot of Spielberg's 70s and 80s work. So, you know, take that for what you will. You know, sticking with Miyazaki, he of course has done a lot of movies. So we are going to go through some of these very quickly, and I'm going to go through some of the ones that maybe he doesn't get as much acclaim for first, because as I said, I want to spend a lot of time talking about the rest of them, and I'm going to go backwards. So what did we think of The Wind Rises, Rachel?
Not good on that one.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Aaron?
I am striking out today, guys. I am so sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, you know, that's totally fine. So, Aaron, your thoughts on The Wind Rises?
I thought it was a perfect final film for him until he decided that he's never actually retiring. As you may or may not know, Ghibli is the Italian word for wind. He has always been fascinated with the Italians and with aviation and with wind. And so this was kind of the perfect story for him to tell. The Japanese Zeros are mythic in their own right. They were designed by Japanese engineers after visiting Italy. It is a really good movie without being great. There's a lot of really cool stuff in it, but ultimately falls a little short. So.
So now you mentioned Ponyo earlier, and since you had your say on Ponyo, and I had my say on Ponyo, I don't think we need to say much more than, folks, if you like The Little Mermaid, do yourself a favor and watch this one. It's really neat. So Now, Rachel, you've seen Howl's Moving Castle, maybe?
Yes, I have.
Oh. Okay, now here's one that I have to say, I don't think it's a great movie, but I love the way it looks. And I'll leave it at that. So, Rachel?
Well, that's kind of where I was going to go with that. Yes, it's a beautiful story, you know, Enchanted Castle, witch, blah. It's a lot prettier sounding on paper than it is as a story on the screen, but thank God that Studio Ghibli was involved with it because it's visually pleasing as well. You don't even have to understand what they're saying to just watch it and make a really pretty story.
Yeah. So, Aaron?
First of all, I think I liked it more than both of you. I really like this one. I agree that it's a beautiful film to look at. Totally lost my train of thought. Oh, boy. Calcifer is one of my favorite characters of all time. He's just so funny. And, sorry, dubs, not dubs, people, Billy Crystal's dubbing of Calcifer is amazing. I think it's one of those movies I hated it the first time I saw it. I've liked it a little more every time I've seen it, and I've seen it about 5 times now. So I'm up to pretty high on it without, you know, being over the moon about it.
That might be what I need to do. I might need to show it to the kids and watch it another time and see if my feelings change.
Well, you know, sometimes our experiences and or our moods at the time can really affect the way that we appreciate a movie. I know the first time I saw Lawrence of Arabia, which is now my number 3 all-time film, I didn't hate the movie. I just was kind of cold on it. I thought, yeah, it's a pretty film, but I didn't really get much from it. Granted, I was about 10 or 12 when I watched it, but I'd seen other movies at 10 and 12. I was watching Last Emperor whenever it came on cable. You know, I watched Color Purple whenever it came on cable. You know, longer period films, they appealed to me. But the second time I watched it, when I was a little older, about 16, I loved it. And it immediately became a top 10 film for me. And then I watched it a few years later, and it became my number 3 film and has sat there sandwiched in between, for the longest time it was sandwiched in between The Apartment and Goodfellas, but now it's sandwiched in between The Apartment and Sunrise. But that's a digression. So, Rachel, what are your thoughts on Porco Rosso?
We talked about that earlier. I don't think I've seen that one.
Okay, no, I wasn't sure if that was, no, that's the one obviously you haven't seen, yes. So, sorry about that.
What about you? Is this
Raccoon
Balls?
What about you, Aaron? Yeah, no, Raccoon Balls, no, Raccoon Balls, no. The Porco Rosso is the one about the flying pig. Now, I know that Aaron listed this as his, probably his least favorite Miyazaki, so let's expound on that, Aaron. What is it that doesn't work here for you?
I don't know, because it's also his funniest movie. It's about a fighter pilot who is super cocky and gets cursed and turned into a pig and then embarrasses people, usually Nazis, And then finally he wins his humanity back at the end of the movie in a really tangled bet about a fighter dogfight airplane competition, I think. I guess my ultimate complaint about Porco Rosso is that it shouldn't be a movie that you ever have to say, I guess, or I think about. It should be a pretty straightforward movie, and it's not.
Yeah. So now we're going to get into those early great Miyazaki's, the classic run. So Kiki's Delivery Service, you've seen this one, Rachel?
Yes.
So your thoughts?
That's a really cute one, but it just kind of, for me, is adorable enough to slip into the category of I don't really care about it.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I like the cat. That was about it.
Oh, yeah, the cat's adorable. The bike. Yay! Kiki's Delivery Service. It's really cute. It's really fun. It is not a bad movie at all. I actually own it, but it's one of those movies, like, that I own and forget about, even though it's in a glass case of DVDs that I see every day. Because it's a fun romp.
Yep.
That's what I'll say. Siskel and Ebert gave it 2 thumbs up. Fun romp.
So, Aaron, your thoughts on this one?
I can buy into that. It's probably his most unapologetically for kids movie. And I'm including Ponyo in that. It's with the possible exception of Totoro, but Totoro has a little more depth to it.
I mean, same.
I don't really know how to expound on that. It's one I really like when I'm watching it. I don't necessarily ever go out of my way to watch it, but I'm excited about showing it to my kids who are small. And we'll watch it, and we'll watch it probably 3 times, one for each of them, and maybe throw it on again sometime later.
Yeah. So now, what about Castle in the Sky, Rachel?
That one I'm not as familiar with. You may have to remind me the plot.
That's the one that basically feels like it's taken off from the Brobdingnagian portion of Gulliver's Travels. Yeah, but it's about this big floating city in the sky.
Wow.
With a cool robot.
I'm not going to lie here. There's a whole bunch of those in anime. And also there was a really weird miniseries when I was a kid that involved a floating city in the sky. I think you guys need to talk about that one.
So, Aaron, your thoughts?
I have a hard time differentiating this one with Nausicaa. I feel like he traded the giant bugs for steampunk aesthetic and told a very similar story.
Maybe that's
I like it without loving it. I'd like to see it again at some point. But that's kind of how I feel about Castle in the Sky.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've kind of done all the minor works, and I hate to call any of these minor works, but now I want to go back to Takahata and talk about the tale of Princess Kaguya. Now, Rachel, I can't remember if you've seen Kaguya. Have you seen it?
I'm honestly not sure.
It's the one about the man that finds the girl in the flower and raises her, and she's a magical princess, and it looks like a bunch of watercolors. So doesn't ring a bell.
It's the fucking anime Thumbelina story.
Yes. Yes, if you've seen that one, then let's talk about it.
It really is. It's an early work, but...
No, it's his last work.
No. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, there's, like, beeping in my ear. It is. It's like the anime version of the Thumbelina story. And if you know the original version of the Thumbelina story, it's not just that, you know, the people raised her out of the flower and she was tiny and happy. No, it was a lot more adult than that.
Yeah, specifically, the thing is, it's one of those interesting things. There's Thumbelina in the West, but specifically, this is the tale of the bamboo cutter. There's always been some discussion about whether or not Hans Christian Andersen was aware of this, and it's possible, being that there had been Dutch trading with Japan, so it's very possible that he may have been aware of it, and that may actually be based on this, which I think is very interesting. So what about you, Aaron? What are your thoughts on Princess Kaguya?
It's my favorite Takahata film. There are times I think it might even be his best. I'm never willing to commit to that.
It's fucking gorgeous.
Unapologetically gorgeous. It may be the best looking animated film I've ever seen.
It took him like 14 years between My Neighbor Yamada's and this one. That's how much care he took with that movie.
Yeah, it's every frame, every picture is just incredibly detailed, incredibly delicate. Oh, I don't know if I can say much more. It's a great movie on top of the way it looks, but the way it looks is so important to the film itself. That it's hard not to be all-encompassing.
Yeah. And now we come to the big one, the film that I think is his masterpiece. Now, I hope I get the story right, and I'm probably going to mess this up a little bit, and it depends on the translation, because, of course, the original story was in Japanese, and then it got translated when it was reported in English. But Grave of the Fireflies is based on a novel that is semi-autobiographical. Grave of the Fireflies is about a brother and sister who, as the film begins, the brother dies and joins his sister's spirit, and you then see how they came to the point of how they died. This is a tale of the end of World War II. Their father, who is a pilot, has gone missing, presumed dead in the war. Their mother dies because of a firebombing. They go to live with an aunt who cheats them out of what's rightfully theirs. They end up living in a hovel by the side of the road. The sister eats dirt until she dies because she's starving to death. literally, and it's about how they try but fail to persevere. The author of the book said that I did not survive the war. My body is alive. My spirit died with my sibling. So that should tell you everything you need to know about watching this film.
And it's not as fun as that.
No.
I mean,
so,
what the fuck do you expect me to say about that movie? Do you want me to just, like, sob into the phone right now? Or, I mean, I've seen it.
Yeah, I saw it once. It was burned into my memory. I may, in about 20 years' time, and it's been a long time since I've seen the movie, it may end up taking me 30, 40 years before I'm able to see that movie a second time. It's that powerful of a work.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm just going to like be over here in the corner sobbing quietly into my headset while you guys talk about this movie, because holy fuck, it is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. This movie right here is the difference between Takahata and Miyazaki, because this movie came out before it was actually Studio Ghibli, but it is still associated. So, like, I'm getting queasy just thinking about watching that movie.
So, Aaron, your thoughts?
It's a masterpiece of the war film genre, as Roger Ebert said. It's not a masterpiece of animation. It's not a masterpiece of anti-war films. It's a masterpiece of the entire war film genre. It is also the single most devastating war film ever made, because it's about children and the effect that it has on real lives, and about the effects that it has on people who have nothing to do with the people who are fighting the war. I am getting emotional thinking about it right now.
it's a powerful film.
It's absolutely punishing to watch. I hope if you haven't seen it, we haven't turned you off from seeing it, because it deserves to be watched, and it needs to be watched, and it needs to be felt.
It is the most important war film of all time.
Yes. Let it break you. You need to let it, but it will break you.
Let it crush your soul. You need it. It's a good thing. This is actually a good thing.
Like the boy in the striped pajamas that I brought up earlier. This is like that on Southern meth. I mean, it is like so intense, but it is beautiful and amazing, and you have to watch it to understand why we need to make things better in the world.
Yeah. Yep. So now turning our attention to happier things, we are going to go back to Hayao Miyazaki, and we are going to discuss his first truly major film, and that is the splendid Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. So, Rachel?
I could go off for days on this one, to the point that people that I associated with back in the early days of the online had a pen name or handles. Their handles were things like Nausicaä, blah, blah, blah. This has been, like, ingrained into me since I was a kid, and I am sorry, it's one of those animes that just, wow, it is epic. 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 There's no way to even describe everything that goes on in this. And we were talking about it earlier. My kid was gifted just the book series of it, and it's so heavy that it's hard to pick up. And to be able to put a story like that into animation and make it such a flowing, beautiful, I don't know, it gets me kind of emotional how pretty that anime is.
You know, it really is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. And it's, you know, it's based on a manga that Miyazaki had done a few years earlier, as you mentioned earlier. And those chicken creatures that he has, those remind me, of course, of some birds that are in the Final Fantasy video game series known as chocobos.
Yeah,
and a lot of people like
chocobos.
People like to point to Nausicaa as where the chocobos came from, but Miyazaki likes Western work. Miyazaki likes the work of Ralph Bakshi. Ralph Bakshi's film Wizards features a very similar creature to that. So I've always thought that Yoshitaka Amano, who came up with the design for the chocobo, likely saw what Miyazaki did, who I think was probably influenced, I may be wrong, by Bakshi. So it may be possible that the chocobo owes its primordial existence to Ralph fucking Bakshi, which I think is pretty kind of cool.
I totally agree with you there, and I will just say that I've seen the chocobos, and I've seen all of it, and yes, I had the same feeling with Nausicaa. Is I thought that they're too similar to not be inspired by one or the other. Because you never know. I mean, the guys could have had a, you know, weird bar lunch meeting back in the day before either of those was made and talked about making weird chicken creatures with tail feathers and shit. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Aaron, what are your thoughts on Nausicaa?
I like it without loving it. I think it's the prototype of the masterwork that he started doing kind of in the middle section of his career. I think it's really outstanding. I just think it's a little raw. And maybe my feelings on it will have changed. I do need to see it again. Obviously, along with Castle in the Sky, since I can't tell you which one's which, other than Bugs versus Castle. but
yeah.
His films always, not always, his films, his best films, always have a young female protagonist standing in the middle of men wreaking havoc. And this starts there.
yep.
So it is a masterwork. I think it's the prototype for his greatest masterworks, more than it is his greatest. But if you think it's his best, I am not going to fight you on that.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people respond, and I know I'm one of them. I don't think it's his best film, but I really respond strongly to how damn enjoyable it is. it's a hell of a lot of fun, and it's very imaginative, and it's very competently made. So we're going to take a short break from the discussion of films and welcome in Carl Kafer. So, Carl, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. How are you?
We're well. So, Carl, there is an announcement for the Deviant Legion family of shows that Carl would like to make.
Actually, I'm going to pass it over to Rachel first. So, Rachel,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was expecting Carl to speak first, but forgive me if I get a little emotional, guys. I'm really sorry, but I wrote this out earlier. Ladies, gentlemen, and folks of all persuasions, it is with a heavy heart and mind that I must announce the passing of one who was truly a shining star, not only in our constellation of weirdness at the Deviant Legion Network and ISF, Incredibly Strange Films, but for the galactic good at large. Derek Ferguson, when not loving on his adoring wife Patricia or spending time with his film and media group, Cine Darrow, he was writing best-selling Pulp Fiction series Dylan, fantastically insightful movie reviews, and mentoring aspiring writers and podcasters such as myself. He was always quick with a kind word and constructive criticism that didn't make you feel like a demolished building site. Though his light has dimmed on this mortal plane, he will forever shine on in the hearts and minds of all of us that he touched. And from all of us at the Deviant Legion Network and Incredibly Strange Films, and everyone that he touched in his life, you will truly, truly be missed, adored, and remembered, Derek. Thank you for being here for us.
Wow. I can't say more than that. I will, however, like to mention a couple things. Derek was on our podcast several times. Both on Deviant Legion and then when I was with Steve's video store with Steve Ronquillo. Derek was a very, very special person. I had him on specifically since he was a writer of Black Pulp. We did a whole series on blaxploitation films. And I tried to get him on in February, this past February for Black History Month, but he was too busy. And I would have never guessed that I wouldn't have the chance to have him on again. The man was one of the best people that I have ever run across. He was incredibly supportive of me and what we're doing here at Deviant Legion. Even though he was a podcaster, even though he was a writer and I'm not, it didn't matter to him. To everyone who knew him, who was on his Facebook group, You See Me Darrow. My heart goes out to everyone because we will all miss him. I absolutely think that you should, I'll be posting some of the shows that he was on here in a little bit. But also, he was an incredible writer of pulp fiction. Black Pulp.
You can buy all of his stuff on Amazon. I looked it up earlier. He has an amazingly rated pulp fiction series called Dylan that is...
And Vril like, also. Just an amazing amount of work. He was very supportive of Rachel just starting out. And as I said, he was very supportive. He would give me messages in PM like, you got to do this a little better. You got to do that, but you're doing good. And it was always a pleasure to have him on. And when I woke up this morning and found out he had passed, I was shell-shocked. seriously was shell-shocked. Not post-traumatic stress disorder, shell-shocked. I was shocked because it's a voice that we won't have except for what he's written, and there is a voice there. So he's not forgotten. He never will be. And God bless having him in my life. And that's what I have to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that's a little bit of a different, usually we do this part, but before you go, Carl, is there anything coming up for your shows other than when you can get it together, a tribute to Derek?
Yes, we have a lot going on, actually. We have a lot going on. Tomorrow, let me, here, hold on. I got to just sort of switch gears here. Okay. Tomorrow, yeah, I mean, seriously, I just have to switch gears and, like, get into business mode.
Sorry about
tomorrow
that.
We have the first of a series of commentary watches that we are doing in tandem with ISF. And as you know, watch parties are leaving Facebook Watch. Now they have cast. They're going to be using cast for their watches. But I'm sure that people won't, it won't be as valuable as it was with Facebook Watch. So we're doing a series of commentary watches on films that are available for streaming for free. If you have, you know, the, you know, Amazon or whatever the case would be. And the first one we're doing is on Amazon Prime for free. It's a gritty little 70s film called Deadly Hero, starring Don Murray, Deanne Williams, and James Earl Jones. And it's part of my group of 70s hidden gems. And we'll be doing a lot of those off of Amazon, because Amazon's just, like, loaded with 70s films. It's wonderful.
Well, they have that one, oh, God, that movie that you've listed as your unheralded gem of all unheralded gems, that little, that funky little, that Western. I just forgot the name of the movie, Carl. You know the one I'm talking about.
China 9, Liberty 37?
No, I want to
say
Red Sun. No, it's the one that Downey did.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yep, I literally just had the film on the tip of my tongue because it's one of those movies that I'd looked for years to see it again, because I'd seen it on VHS when I was a kid. And then you mentioned it, and I was like, shit, I wonder if it's on Amazon. Because, you know, Prime, as you said, is a great resource. They have a whole bunch of movies you wouldn't think are there.
Yeah. Seriously,
and especially, like, B and C and Z-grade movies. Shit that...
That
people otherwise
mean,
we don't really care about it, but, you know, it's cool that they're available because there's still a lot of fun to be had, and there's always something good in even the worst movies.
That's why I'm doing this, Adam, because I'm going to be picking out films that deserve to be watched.
Exactly. I think that's why we all do what we do at DLN. I know part of what I'm trying to do is – especially with some of my more esoteric series that I've chosen to spotlight, I'm trying to bring, some publicity, some attention to things that I think people maybe aren't as aware of, either because it's very old material or it's material that may be known in Europe and the United Kingdom but isn't so known here.
Very true, very true. And that's what we try to do. So that will be tomorrow. We're recording at 3 o'clock, and then it'll be available for all time. So you just go to Amazon, find the movie, get it ready, turn on the podcast, turn down the volume, and listen to our commentary, just like it's a DVD. And
yep.
I'll have a lot of information on it about the director. I did a lot of research on this, so it'll be a good presentation. And along with me, there will be Rachel and Doc will join us for that. Now, on Tuesday...
I promise I'm probably not going to cry during the podcast tomorrow night.
Well, it's tomorrow afternoon, dear, but yes.
Yep.
It's nighttime somewhere, just like it's going to be 5 o'clock somewhere.
yeah, probably in England at that point. So anyway, on Tuesday, the ISF podcast, we're very, very happy to have Joel Weinkoop come back. Joel has
I love Joel.
Yes, he's a wonderful character. We love Joel. He is a micro-budget director out of Tampa. And he just finished post-production and got it released and got it out for distribution, the Craiglaw incident. And he's actually already started on the sequel. And who knows, we might even get Tim Ritter in on this too. Because I contacted Tim because Tim is co-producing this.
Stop talking so dirty to me like that, Paul. You're bringing up all my favorite people.
Yeah, I know. They're good people.
Present that, company excluded.
but you know, that's what we try to do. And that was the reason for Derek, for doing the announcement on Derek, because he was part of the family. And all of these
people. He really
was. And
we're
just so appreciative of everyone that comes on.
I've had very limited interaction with
him
on the board, but he seemed like a really good one.
Oh, yeah, he was. There's no doubt about it. So what do you have for next week? Do you have anything for next
week?
Well,
next week we are going to be doing on Cathode Ray Mission. Our next episode will be on the British miniseries, The Singing Detective, which, of course, was later turned into a tremendously terrible, no-good, very bad film with Robert Downey Jr., and the original far superior. The week after that, we will be having the flip side to last week's fun episode. Last week we did our favorite pilot episodes. 2 weeks from tonight, we will be doing our favorite series finales. And then sometime after that, sometime getting into May, we will be having another director spotlight. I kind of have a thought on who I want to do, but it depends on the guests. But right now I can only say that I have the next two episodes firmly lined up. And I hope to see you all there. And, you know, you guys are welcome to come back in like you did last week and join us again for the TV finales, which I think should be another fun one.
Yeah, I'll be in on that one for sure.
I have seen a lot of TV finales recently, and some of them have pissed me off. Are we allowed to talk about the ones that we hate the most?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, there's going to be a
good
section for that. There's
yeah,
going to be a section
deal
for that.
I may need to be in on that.
But yeah, so getting back to the show, and thank you for coming on, Carl, and that was beautifully stated, a beautiful tribute to Derek there, Rachel. But getting back to
okay,
our...
I'm going to disappear, guys, so I'll talk to you later. Good show.
Yep.
I've been listening for a while, so go right ahead.
Have a good one. Thanks.
All right.
So getting back to the last three or four films that we have here, and I'll start with you, Aaron. My Neighbor Totoro, what are your thoughts on this one?
Rare is the movie without an antagonist. And most of them don't work, because if there's no conflict, there's no drama. but I defy you to name the actual conflict in My Neighbor Totoro, because there isn't any. It's just a magnificent work about the lives of children, the innocence of children. Yeah, their mom's sick, but she's not that sick. I mean, she's sick enough to be in the hospital, but she's sitting up in bed. We get to see her. They get to talk to her. She comes
home
at the end. Right.
More like she's not dead yet, but whatever.
Yeah, well, you know, I never got the feeling in the movie, it might have just been me, I never got the feeling that the illness was something that the adults were worried she wasn't going to pull through, you know? But that may have just been
right,
my impression when I saw it. Mm-hmm.
I guess I can see that.
But it's about their world. It's about the children's world. And it's about the way we interact with it and how they interact with us and how they learn their place in the world. And forest gods, but much less intimidating ones than we see in Princess Mononoke.
Or even shoot it away.
One of the most glorious films ever made, because there's such charm and innocence to it, without cheating you on a story or on substance.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a really beautiful film. So, Rachel.
Yes, sir.
Your thoughts on this one?
Well, frankly, I was going to say get out of my head here, because really there's no sort of dark presence in this movie. Even the darkest presence of the movie is the mother's illness, which, like you said, she's actually recovering from in the hospital. And I didn't think about it like that initially. It's like, you know, mom's in the hospital, you automatically think that it's terminal because that's the plot point you use in a movie. But no, she's like recovering from her illness. It's not a bad thing. I don't want to say this, but this is kind of just a genuinely pure children's movie.
In the best sense of the word, it doesn't insult the adults. It absolutely doesn't insult the children. It doesn't speak down to anyone. It speaks to universal human emotions and thoughts. And you know, there's a level of empathy and understanding in it that is universal and rare. You know, it's a good
family
film. In the best
exactly,
sense of the term.
Because I have an almost 4-year-old, I have an almost 12-year-old, I have a 36-year-old and myself, and then, you know, if my parents want to come over, I've got some people in their 60s and 70s, and that is a movie that I could literally put on and all of us could sit in a room and watch together, and I would have no drama about.
Yeah. So now we have two more films, and these are usually listed as his greatest films. I think they probably are his two best films. And the first one is Princess Mononoke. Now, Aaron, what are your thoughts on Princess Mononoke?
So this is the logical conclusion for the man. And, okay, preface. This was his first last film. And it was the logical conclusion to the career of the man who made Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. This is a film about a incredibly fierce woman standing in the gap, though this time he recognizes he has a powerful female antagonist as well. So it's not only men, it's adults, adult humans, who are wreaking havoc on the world, and once again, children having to pick up. This deals with his career-long obsession with nature and with human impact on it. And it's one of the most fiercely environmentalist films I think that's ever been made. Big themes here, but physical themes. The next one is more metaphysical in nature. This one's more physical, dealing with humanity and the darkness in all of us, and how fighting those that we hate only makes the hate worse, and the hate only makes the fighting worse, and how that's the scourge of humanity. And how if we don't stop, we're just going to have nothing left because the gods are leaving and the dumb beasts will follow and the trees. And dealing with a lot of heavy stuff in this film.
And yet it has some real funny stuff in there. It has some really gentle stuff. And the gentle stuff isn't necessarily used to calm, but to disturb, because you see how gentle it is, and you realize this is what's being lost. And you really go, shit. it's a very powerful,
very
powerful
Harrison
film.
Bergeron at that point, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Rachel, your thoughts on this one?
I mean, honestly, you did a lovely job describing that movie, and my thoughts on it are that James Cameron and Avatar, he watched Princess Mononoke maybe when he was stoned and decided, I'm going to make it different because obviously this is anime, so I've got to pick a different, you know, nationality. I can't go Asian, so Native American, that's what I'm going to do. And boom, now we have the Avatar films, which apparently there's a new one coming out. And
yeah, and every time we turn
stop.
Around, they're announcing, no, it's going to be it's going to be two sequels. No, three. No, five. No, six. Well,
yeah, but the next one's not going to come out for the next 47 and a half years. And frankly, I don't think the first movie needed a sequel, but we're not going to get into that. I really feel like James Cameron was super inspired by this movie to make the Avatar series, but he was pissed off because he could not culturally appropriate the Japanese and fucking use the Native Americans instead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. So now we come to our final film, and I'll stick with you, Rachel. What are your thoughts on Spirited Away?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. Obviously, most people do. I mean, it's definitely one of the most famous out of either group, either director, either any of them. My thoughts on Spirited Away are because of my first experience with it. It really made me understand that anime can be okay for children too, because I was basically a kid when I watched it. And I appreciate that movie in ways that it's not my favorite anime by any stretch of the imagination. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. But it's good slash pretty good enough to get other people interested to further dive into the genre. So, hands down, it's one of the top five that you need to list for, like, people that want to know what anime's about. Like, oh, you watch that weird adult Japanese cartoon shit?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you, I would probably put this one or Princess Mononoke. I would actually maybe put Vampire Hunter D. And I will always put Tokyo Godfathers. I fucking love that film to death.
Yes. No, that's what I'm saying is I did not bring up Vampire Hunter D because I could go there all fucking day.
Yeah, and we will. And we will. One day we'll have to do a show on
Talk dirty to me.
On that, maybe we'll do a show on the Final Fantasy series and Yoshitaka Amano and get into Vampire Hunter D that way. But we've got about 8 minutes left to the show, so Aaron, your thoughts on Spirited Away?
It's an absolute masterpiece of animation. It's like my tied for a favorite animated film of all time.
What's the other one?
My number two. Beauty and the Beast.
Well, Beauty and the Beast is just amazing. It's a Broadway movie. It's a great work of animation. And that opening sequence where the Beast is cursed is just lovely.
The stained glass in there.
And the crane
shot. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
The crane shot. This is the first time I realized that movies were being made while I was watching animation. Anyway, another show. Spirited Away is also a masterpiece of young adult fiction. And as an English teacher, you must realize that I don't use that in a ghettoized way. There are
I didn't realize you were an English teacher, but awesome.
The genre as a whole is about finding yourself. It's about learning who you are. It's about placing yourself into the context of the world and learning who you are. And Chihiro has to remember her name. Literally, that is the plot of the movie, is she has to remember who she is and she has to save herself from this world that she's found herself in without any help from adults.
Yeah, typically in mythology, the name, your true name, is your power over yourself. And if you don't have that, if somebody else has your true name, they have the power over you. You don't have that.
When you see that in, like, demonology, you see that in Rumpelstiltskin, the person with the name has the power. When you name something, you take its power. And
exactly.
She has to remember who she is, and she has to fight everything that comes in her way in order to do it. And it's, I mentioned this Princess Mononoke is physical. It deals with the physical themes that we deal with in art. This deals with the metaphysical themes. And really, they're two pieces of a whole, I think, in that way. they look at the completeness of us as a species, the physical and the spiritual, and I love this movie unapologetically.
It's a lovely movie. I have to say that when I was younger, I was 16. I'm 40. I was 16 when Princess Mononoke came out. I was 21 when this came out. Both times I took family members with me to see them. And both times they walked out going, "So wait, that's what anime's like?" I said, "Sometimes." Both films managed to convert family members into, if not actually loving anime, being open to it. And I think that's a tremendously important step. And I think that's really, for me, what Studio Ghibli does is they're so accessible in the best way. They're not simple. They're not stupid, but they're accessible. And it's a great way of saying, hey, look, anime does this over here, but it also does this here. It really proves that in Japan, you know, animation is just another way of doing a movie, whereas over here, it kind of gets pushed into a less respected corner, which is unfortunate. But that's a
freaky weirdo category.
Yeah, but that's a whole other show that we can do another time. But I do want to bring this to an end. It's been a lovely show, tinged with some sadness because of the passing of a friend to Deviant Legion. But it was, as always, it was great. Thank you out there for listening. Thank you for coming on. I'll see you next week, Aaron, on that Singing Detective episode. And Rachel and I'll see both of you 2 weeks after that for the TV finale episode. That should be a lot of fun. I definitely have some choices already. But we will see each other over the next few weeks. Hope you'll be with us next Friday and the one after that and every Friday that we're on and the occasional Saturday episode. So from all of us, thank you and good night.
Good night.